It is Friday, December the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, helping men, women, and children get out of harm's way in eastern Aleppo, Syria.
In total, 3,000 people were evacuated on Thursday alone, including 40 severely injured people and children.
Also ahead, the plight of child soldiers in South Sudan, possible Russian hacking during the U.S. election, and a film from renowned director Martin Scorsese. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad says history would be made with what he referred to as the liberation of Aleppo. The message came in a video posted to his official Twitter account. Assad likened his government's recapture of Aleppo to other historical events, including the fall of the Soviet Union, and said history would be permanently altered. A new three-day ceasefire is designed to permit the evacuation of civilians and wounded. However, several issues remain of concern, according to the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry.
We remain deeply concerned as well that we are hearing reports of Syrian men between the ages of 18 and 40 who have apparently been detained or conscripted into military service when trying to pass through government checkpoints, and that some who of these actually went missing days or even weeks ago, and we still don't have, families don't have, their loved ones don't have accountability for what has happened to them. Obviously, these actions are despicable, and they're contrary to the laws of war and to basic human decency.
Ambulances and government buses began evacuating wounded and other civilians from the latest rebel-held areas of Aleppo, moving out of besieged eastern Aleppo through government-held territory into another rebel-held part of that province. International Committee for the Red Cross says the evacuation of rebels and civilians from Aleppo is likely to take several days. That evacuation was arranged under a ceasefire deal brokered by Turkey and Russia this week to allow rebels to withdraw from the last remaining sliver of Aleppo under their control. Anna Nelson is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking here with International Edition's Lori London about the efforts to finally assist suffering civilians.
The International Committee of the Red Cross, along with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, were able to carry out several rounds of evacuations from Aleppo, from eastern Aleppo, during the day on Thursday. My understanding is that a fourth evacuation may be underway, but in total, 3,000 people were evacuated on Thursday alone, including 40 severely injured people and children.
Where are they taking them?
So people are being bused to areas in western Aleppo and in Idlib province. We're essentially facilitating the evacuation and the transfer, and then local charities, hospitals, welcoming them upon their arrival.
And what about the folks that are injured?
The folks that are injured are being taken to hospitals and healthcare units in western Aleppo and in Idlib province.
Do you have any idea how many more people are still trapped inside that city?
That is really the big question right now. It's hard to say how many people are still inside eastern Aleppo. We're predicting that it could take another few days to be able to get everybody out. We were able to get 3,000 out in one day alone, so we see that as a very positive first step. But of course, the main thing is that the ceasefire needs to continue to hold, and that all the parties involved in the fighting continue to show goodwill in ensuring that we can have access and be able to facilitate these evacuations.
With the city pretty much in ruins and people fearing for their lives and huddled together in whatever way they can, trying to take cover, how are rescue workers going about trying to locate these people to get them out?
The first important step, obviously, was to get the different parties to agree to the ceasefire. That was a really major hurdle. Nothing could happen until that took place. Once that happened, the ICRC, about 12 staff members from the ICRC and around 100 Syrian Arab Red Crescent volunteers went in with a convoy. When they started to enter eastern Aleppo, they heard shots fired. Luckily, no one in the convoy was injured. They saw smoke pluming from buildings. They saw cars on fire. They had to use a crane to get rid of the rubble on the streets so that they could bring the ambulances in. So, you know, right from the very start, it was very tense. It was hard to know if it would go ahead. Luckily, it did. People, I think, have been waiting for this. We've seen on social media people sending messages asking for help, asking to be able to get to safety. So people have been waiting for this. I'm not on the ground. My assumption is that once word got out that the convoy was there, that people started coming forward.
Right. And what else did they describe seeing, and how do they go about themselves staying safe?
Our head of delegation for all of Syria, who was leading the convoy, her name is Marianne Gasser. She's been in Syria for many years now, and she's a seasoned ICRC humanitarian. She's been in a lot of conflict zones, and she told us that when they entered eastern Aleppo, she saw some of the worst destruction and human suffering that she's ever seen. And when somebody like that, who's so experienced in this, tells you that, it really does say something about the suffering that's been going on. People have been going without heat. Fuel is in short supply. Food is very scarce. Water has been scarce. It's the middle of winter. Healthcare has been pretty much non-existent in eastern Aleppo. So people have just been living in really dire circumstances. And of course, in a tremendous amount of fear.
It's amazing that they even have internet to be able to say they need help.
You know, as a humanitarian, I think one of the things that you realize is that along with food and water and shelter, information is a basic need. And often before people even want something to drink or something to eat, they want to know, is my father safe? Is my child safe? Where is my wife? Where is my husband? So social media has clearly, in addition to being a mechanism for people to talk about their own needs, is also proving to be an important link to each other.
The rebels seized eastern Aleppo in 2012, but lost mostly all of it in recent weeks to a devastating air and ground offensive following a months-long siege. We were just listening to Anna Nelson. She is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, and she was speaking with my colleague Lori London. Among the other stories we're following here on The Voice of America, Ghanaian president-elect keeps the campaign promises. He says he will do that. EU extending its sanctions on Russia. Also, post-impeachment South Korean presidential race underway. A lot more on those stories at our website, voanews.com, and as always on the VOA mobile app. UNICEF is reporting that children in South Sudan continue to be recruited by military forces and armed groups. The two largest parties to the conflict in South Sudan, the SPLA and the SPLA in opposition, both signed agreements with the United Nations to end the recruitment and prevent the use of children in combat. However, with continued conflict, a rise in child soldiers is occurring. Some 1,300 children have been recruited this year. That brings the total number of children used in conflict to somewhere around 17,000 since 2013. James Elder is a regional chief of communications for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa. He just returned from a trip to South Sudan and spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the rise in recruitment of child soldiers despite the agreement between the warring parties.
I think it's saying that there are agreements that aren't being fully implemented, like all aspects of this conflict. The people most impacted are children. So those agreements around peace accords, those agreements around upholding their own signatories to international law around child recruitment that are not being met are, of course, putting the most vulnerable citizens of South Sudan at more and more risk. And we're seeing that in South Sudan now. We're seeing that in these continuous increases in child recruitment just at a time when, you know, the middle of this year, people were very hopeful that the citizens of the country may finally start to see something like a dividend of peace.
What regions are most affected by this in South Sudan?
This was limited to a couple of states around Unity State, but of course the conflict in various forms has spread from that into the Equatorias. There's been reports of violence in many more areas of the country than we saw even 3 or 4 months ago, which is again another cause of concern for the international community, because it just means that those few places where families were moving to try and get some refuge, to try and get some respite from conflict, also now don't offer, you know, the peace and security that they once did.
What types of abuses are the children experiencing right now?
Unfortunately, the children of South Sudan are experiencing almost every abuse that the adult mind can conjure. They are being recruited, and when a child, of course, is recruited, whether or not they're in the front line, they face risk of death. If they're in the front line, then of course they see and sometimes commit unspeakable horrors. Children who haven't been recruited are still in villages that are often under attack. Amid this entire crisis, even those children who have somehow managed to escape violence are living in a state where social services are close to collapse. And if it wasn't for, you know, organizations like UNICEF or the World Food Program, then levels of hunger would be even more severe and malnutrition than they are. So children who've even escaped and aren't in direct line of fire are at grave risk of malnutrition, of grave risk of disease, of malaria. Unfortunately, it's a really long list. It's hard to think of a country where kids suffer more, and that's at a time when we realize just that there are many, many countries around the world where children are suffering.
What is South Sudan's government saying about this situation with children?
Well, government remains a partner when we try and work on things like education and trying to get what it will be tens of thousands of teachers trained. South Sudan has the highest portion of children out of school on the planet. The government, I think, acknowledges the enormity of the situation facing children, but at the same time, the UN will make very clear that what is mostly needed right now is peace and access. And the children of South Sudan don't have peace, and some United Nations agencies don't have the access to reach those most vulnerable people. So they're the two things that are most required right now for the kids of this long-suffering, very new nation.
You all have documented that at least 1,300 children have been recruited in 2016. Looking ahead into the next year, what do you see regarding child recruitment?
I wish I had that crystal ball. I think that in the middle of this year, there was increasing optimism among South Sudanese, among those people who work in the country, who work in really, really difficult, dangerous conditions. Of course, the conflict that broke out again in July set children and many others back a long way. What happens in 2017 is, of course, very much up to the government and the opposition forces as to, you know, how best they can really represent the interests of their children. I wish I knew. I certainly know that the dozens and dozens of families that I've met across that country have more resolve and sort of fortitude and resilience in the face of just dire, dire situations. But of course, no one can go on forever when these people have exhausted all coping mechanisms, have sold off what meager assets they've had, are moving around the country, are unable to plant crops. Then 2017 could be a year of even graver food insecurity, again, if violence doesn't stop.
As James Elder, he is a regional chief of communications for UNICEF, that's in Eastern and Southern Africa, and he was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Well, the White House on Thursday said the statement from intelligence agencies released in October on Russian hacking was pretty obvious about who they were referring to. White House spokesman Josh Earnest was addressing a daily press briefing hours after three U.S. officials said Russian President Vladimir Putin supervised his intelligence agency's hacking of the U.S. presidential election and turned it in from a general effort to discredit the process to a specific attempt to support now President-elect Donald Trump.
I think what is relevant at this point is to consider the statement that was made back on October 7th. This was the statement that was issued by the intelligence community. It reflected the unanimous opinion and conclusion of all 17 intelligence agencies. And they reported publicly that Russia was engaged in malicious cyber activity to erode public confidence in our democracy. They included another sentence that I believe is worth repeating, so let me just read it here. That statement included in part, "We believe, based on the scope and sensitivity of these efforts, that only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities." That is a statement from the intelligence community that was made public on October 7th. At the risk of editorializing, when I read that statement for the first time in early October, I didn't think it was particularly subtle.
Accusations that Russia tried to influence the November presidential election by hacking people and institutions, including Democratic Party institutions, has angered President-elect Trump, who says he won the vote fairly. Russian officials have denied all accusations of interference in the U.S. election. NBC News is reporting, and it did so earlier, that U.S. intelligence officials have a high level of confidence Putin was personally involved in the Russian cyber campaign against the U.S. Republican Congressman Peter King was asked about the NBC report and those in the New York Times and the Washington Post.
To suddenly have appear in the Washington Post and the New York Times, the intelligence community, the CIA, has concluded this. Who? Who in the CIA? Is it John Brennan? Is it some rogue person behind a desk somewhere? This is almost the CIA, people in the intelligence community using disinformation tactics against the president-elect of the United States. And that is just disgraceful. And the fact that they wouldn't even show up today for an intelligence committee briefing to tell us who was saying these things and who's not is disgraceful.
The reports of Russian hacking have raised concerns among both political parties in the U.S. Congress and top Republicans, breaking Trump to call for closer scrutiny. Some Republican lawmakers have also questioned Trump's pick for Secretary of State ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson, who has close business ties to the Russian government. It is time now to check out what's trending on social media. International Edition's Michael Lippin is here with the latest, including what appears to be a heavy news day about the U.S. Electoral College. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Steve. Well, Facebook has the Electoral College as one of its top trending topics today. For the benefit of our listeners, the Electoral College is a group of 538 electors who meet about a month after every U.S. presidential election to formally elect the president who won a majority of the Electoral College votes allocated to all the U.S. states plus D.C. So when the electors meet next Monday, they're usually expected to vote the way the people in their states voted. So if Trump, a Republican, won the most votes in Florida, all of Florida's Electoral College Republican electors would cast their votes for Trump. But we're not so sure this time, with some commentators speculating that some Republican electors may not vote for Trump because quite a few Republicans generally opposed him throughout the campaign. And in recent weeks, some Democratic members of the Electoral College have called on U.S. authorities to brief them on intelligence reports that Russia tried to interfere in the election to the benefit of Trump. So today, those calls got a boost from a Democratic member of Congress, who posted a Facebook message today calling for Monday's Electoral College vote to actually be delayed until all electors have been given access to that intelligence.
So, Michael, I'd be curious about the response that he's had to that idea.
Well, opinions on Facebook are as divided as ever. One critic, Kyle Vardo Colvard, said this on Bayer's Facebook feed: This is just another stall tactic, just another way to try to destroy the credibility of someone, i.e. Trump, who won fair and square. And then there was this comment from a Facebook user who supports Bayer. Norma Flores-Lopez says, "Thank you for your continued leadership. We need to make sure our Electoral College is well informed with the facts before making such an important decision as electing our future president."
Anything else out there that's been trending?
Well, just quickly before I go, it's another Trump story and one that's not flattering toward the president-elect. Vanity Fair magazine writer Tina Nguyen wrote a very critical review of the Trump Grill, a restaurant in Trump Tower, and that story was published today. The review's headline says this: "Trump Grill could be the worst restaurant in America." That's quite something to say. It seems like Donald Trump noticed because he sent out this tweet today. Has anyone looked at the really poor numbers of Vanity Fair magazine? Way down, big trouble, dead. And then Trump said this about Graydon Carter, the magazine's chief editor: "He has no talent, will be out." Well, there's no indication that he's going anywhere, but Trump certainly is not happy with that magazine. And opinion about Tina Nguyen's article is also sharply divided. There was this comment from a Twitter user, Ella Dawson, who liked the story and said, "Godspeed, Tina. Who knew a restaurant review would someday require this level of bravery?" But Tina also had her critics, including a user named Starman63. He said, "Tina, you're not a reporter. Why would your byline state that? You went there, to Trump Grill, looking to bash the hell out of anything and everything." Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, Michael. International Edition's Michael Lippin. By the way, you can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Gaza City can be busy, but it's hard finding work when it remains under an economic blockade. Inside this building are the Gaza Sky Geeks, founded in 2011 by Google and Mercy Corp. Mohammed Tafesh runs an Arabic language humor website, and he gets over a million views. He says, "I studied computer science and electrical engineering for 5 years, but I've learned more here in 1 year." The young entrepreneurs do meet with investors and get support from organizations around the world, but they aren't able to travel and compete internationally. Nuwar Abu Awad, founder of the technology mentor platform Tashbeek, says the world does not know what Gaza is. She says, "I think the biggest problem we have is that we can't properly raise our international profile." Riham Ghanima, whose idea allows designers to share their work, says, "No doubt, the problems of Gaza affect us all, but we keep hoping and working to reach our goals." For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film from Oscar-winning director Martin Scorsese, entitled Silence, opens in limited release on December 23rd. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about that film that involves the story of Jesuit missionaries in Japan.
Ferreira is lost to us. They denounced God in public and surrendered the faith.
That's not possible. Father Ferreira risked his life to spread our faith all over Japan.
It seems to me that our mission here is more urgent than ever. We must go find Father Ferreira.
Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver star with Oscar nominee Liam Neeson in Martin Scorsese's newest film, Silence. Garfield and Driver play two Jesuit priests who travel to Japan to find their mentor and missionary, Father Ferreira, played by Liam Neeson. Word has gotten back to Portugal that Ferreira has renounced the faith, but Garfield's Father Rodrigues and Driver's Father Garp don't believe it. They set out for 17th century Japan, where Christianity is outlawed following the Shimabara Rebellion. Father Ferreira has been taken prisoner by a man known as the Inquisitor, played by Issei Ogata. The Inquisitor soon captures Rodrigues and Garp, and realizing that martyrdom is something they would seek, tortures and kills Catholic villagers instead to tempt the priests to renounce their faith. Liam Neeson says the 160-minute-long film will challenge audiences' views on the nature of faith.
I mean, I think it's a beautiful film. It's incredibly thought-provoking. It's one of those films you don't just forget about when you leave the cinema, you know? Whether you're religious or not, it's very, very questioning and very much thought-provoking, I think, you know?
Adam Driver lost nearly 23 kilograms for his role. The 1 meter, 89 centimeter tall actor, best known for last year's Star Wars The Force Awakens and his role on HBO's Girls, says the physical demands of the role helped provide authenticity to his character.
You're, playing persecuted 17th century Jesuit priests, so it's good to, I think, have a little struggle that, almost a discipline every day to kind of keep it in the world, maybe. But also you're very tired and very hungry, as are the characters, so you're not adding anything on top of the scenes. You're not trying to, like, dress anything up.
Liam Neeson says that working with the exacting Scorsese, who fought a protracted legal battle just to make this film, was both intimidating and rewarding.
He's quite a remarkable director, and when you finish a scene, it's he'll sometimes look at you, and I know that look. It's like, I could have done better, or I should have done this, or maybe I could have done that. But when he's happy, he lets you know, you know? So it's always, you always breathe out a sigh of relief.
Garfield's performance as Father Rodriguez has won him high praise. It is also his second film this year in which a character's faith plays a major role, after Mel Gibson's World War II epic, Hacksaw Ridge. Silence is based on author Shusaku Endo's 1966 novel and also stars Kieran Hines and Tadanobu Asano. It is distributed in the United States by Paramount Pictures and opens in limited release December 23rd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And one last item for you. California researchers naming a newly discovered rare plant after Jimi Hendrix. Found in Baja, California, it has been christened Dudleya hendrixi, or Hendrix's Live Forever. The plant is a succulent and has an enormous lifespan. How about that, huh? Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Just to say thanks to our director, Tracy Carter. Thanks, Tracy. And our engineer, John Ellison. You're a great guy. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a marvelous Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his last scheduled national security address as president, Barack Obama spoke of the importance as well as the limits of military power in the fight against violent extremism. In order to counter terrorism most effectively, it is necessary, he said, to take a long view of the terrorist threat and pursue a smart strategy that can be sustained. One key component, President Obama said, is drawing on the strength of our diplomacy. Terrorists, he noted, would love for us to withdraw from building international coalitions, which over the past few years have proved critically important.
We've rolled back Iran's nuclear program. We've secured nuclear materials around the globe, reducing the risk that they fall into the hands of terrorists. We've eliminated Syria's declared chemical weapons program. All of these steps have helped keep us safe and helped keep our troops safe. Those are the result of diplomacy.
President Obama noted that the terrorists we are fighting in the Mideast and elsewhere claim to fight on behalf of Islam, but, he said, they do not speak for over a billion Muslims around the world, and they do not speak for American Muslims, including many who wear the uniform of the United States of America's military.
If we act like this is a war between the United States and Islam, we're not just going to lose more Americans to terrorist attacks, but we'll also lose sight of the very principles we claim to defend.
The U.S., said President Obama, is a nation where you are judged by the content of your character rather than what you look like or how you worship or where your family came from. That's what separates us from tyrants and terrorists. Remembering that, and our commitment to freedom and our common creed, that right makes might and not the other way around, he said, that's how we can sustain this long struggle. That's how we'll protect this country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.